Segundo here, and I've just returned from a particularly strange community meeting. Jorge suggested to me that I should get out more, since he had been nice enough to present certain magazines to add to my collection. I humored him, even though I was unsure of why Jorge himself had not turned up. I entered a room that had apparently been rented out, looked around, and saw several people who didn't look me in the eye. Then, an older woman asked if any of us were new. I told her I was. She then asked me how many years it had been, and I told her that I didn't know what she was talking about. She encouraged me to be brave, so I took a swig from my tequila flask to prepare myself for what might come, and was then delivered a hostile presence by this woman, who also called herself the organizer. I was then soundly kicked out. She said something about my behavior being inappropriate at an anonymous meeting. I still have no idea what she meant. Maybe they wanted to suggest that I was being creative, but I don't think I'll go back. I did nothing wrong.
So I am here with Arlene Goldbard, author of New Creative Community. Arlene, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Ed. Thank you.
First off, I wanted to actually ask you if we can start by perhaps establishing the terms here. What exactly is a creative community? Because different people have different notions of what community is, and maybe you can sort of define that. You define community in this book as a unit of social organization based on some distinguishing characteristic or affinity. Now, perhaps you can jump off of that point and kind of describe to our listeners here exactly what that means.
Well, in a funny way, it's a noun and a verb, because that's true. That's one definition. Mm-hmm. But functionally, in the book, what I'm writing about is community as a process, that it's always in the process of becoming, that it's a project that's never complete, that it constantly has to be renewed. So the question is, how do you develop social networks where everybody feels a sense of belonging, probably multiple belonging in some way, to different groups, different affinities, where it's new and fresh for everybody, where there are many points of entry for everybody, where there's many points of exchange, where we have questions about each other and we can actually approach each other and get the answers.
Gotcha. But you also note a distinguishing characteristic or affinity. Given that there is some sort of mutual, I guess, some sort of Venn diagram that ties everybody together, I guess the question is, how does the community work against, say, an individual coming in who has their own distinctive kind of ideas of what creation is all about?
Uh-huh. Well, it's kind of a dialectic, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, Marx had this favorite saying, Stadtluft macht frei, city air makes you free,
yeah.
which the sense being that in a place of anonymity, you are free to completely express your individual essence and characteristics, mm-hmm, in a way that you may not be maybe constrained in the small town you came from, because people know your name and your face, and you can fool them once, but you probably can't fool them twice. So there's a truth that a certain degree of anonymity creates a certain degree of social freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And people want that to some extent. You don't want to be surrounded by gossip. You don't want people looking over your shoulder all the time. But the kind of community that I aspire to is one in which there's tremendous permission to be different.
Gotcha. But simultaneously, if you're different, you're going to be standing out. You're not necessarily going to be anonymous here, because you're talking about, like, any sort of stroke you make on the canvas is going to be your particular stroke. So how is that a communal stroke, so to speak?
Well, you know, it's true for all of us. I don't know what your particular cultural heritage or heritages are.
Sure.
But let's take mine, for example. I'm the child of Russian Jewish immigrants on both sides, although they came by pretty different routes to this country. So I'm a first-generation American. So I have some ties to a number of communities and affinity groups that I feel like I belong to. I know some of the social codes, I know some of the language, I know some of what people value and what some of their observances are. And that makes me feel part of. But within that, I'm a strong civil libertarian, so I'm constantly asserting my freedom to express who I am in my own way.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I participate in that community is not just to, you know, salute the flag and march in step,
yeah,
but to be myself within it, to feel supported in being myself.
Your book, though, specifically kind of goes into the nature of creative community within the course of the United States history, specifically the 20th century. You point out at many points how the WPA, among many other programs, has kind of encouraged artists to work or to make a living to pay the rent while they were simultaneously, you know, while the economy's in the shitter, basically.
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of ask you, is this kind of what you mean by creative community? Is creative community sort of a safety net, or is it something more than that? Is a safety net kind of a, you know, attribute of a creative community? Or?
Well, there's a condition of community development that I aspire to. Mm-hmm. And I pretty much just described it to you. So then, what are the instrumentalities of that? What are the... they may be initiatives, they may be laws and rules, they may be social programs, they may be opportunities that create the optimal possibility for everyone to have that sense of multiple belonging and have encouragement to express themselves freely. So during the WPA, a number of conditions converged that made a particular opportunity that was characteristic of that time available. You know, you read in the book that artists were given jobs in the WPA, not so much because people thought it would be a great idea to have sort of social access to their creativity, but because they were characterized as just another industry that was hit hard by the Depression, and there were a lot of unemployed artists.
Yeah.
So the first programs that were initiated just simply had the idea of putting a check in people's pocket.
Yeah.
Then what happened is they realized when we put a check in these artists' pockets, they do all these great things that actually a lot of other people benefit from.
Sure.
And so intentionality came to that, and they started to say, okay, how can we actually develop programs where we're commissioning artists to paint murals, we're in the living theater, we're creating theater troupes in cities across the country, and encouraging them to make plays like Spiro Keat, which was the first public play that opened up the question of syphilis to people, which was a huge epidemic then, or One Third of a Nation, which was about the crisis in housing and in employment and so forth. It was a brilliant stroke of Hallie Flanagan, who was the director of the Living Theater, to say, these creative people aren't just isolated individuals who have good ideas. They're actually expressing the zeitgeist in some way in their personal creativity. They're saying something that's relevant to everybody in the society. And if I support their using their gift in that way, it's going to be good for all of us.
There's two points I want to raise in response to this particular statement. One is the notion of raising an issue, like, for example, this play that raises the awareness of syphilis. The second thing is, well, creative communities don't always work in terms of art. I mean, Remember Happenings, they weren't exactly the greatest of, they didn't exactly have much of a theatrical longevity. So based off of those two points, I should ask, does a creative community, must it have this sort of social awareness? So you cite several examples in which you kind of attach a kind of political or progressive sort of agenda to them. And then the second question, kind of relating to this, is, well, what of the sort of, you know, too many cooks method of producing art?
Yeah. Well, I guess I need to get out my razor here and shave something away, because I'm not actually using the rubric creative community to describe some ultimate product that I'm going toward.
Yeah.
You know how books get titled. You sit around with your publisher and you bat things around and
so
they come
the
up with
then.
Something.
Yeah.
You know, the thrust of the book is that while there are conventional and given social roles for artists and other creative people in society, you know, you're a theater person, right?
Yes, I have done theater.
So, like, if you went to theater school or something, then all the courses you probably took were probably founded on the idea that you were going to get a job, like, writing plays for repertory theater or Broadway or somewhere, and all the other ways of working as a theater artist, some of which are socially embedded and socially conscious, they probably weren't even part of the curriculum. So the thrust of the book is to say there are roles for artists as agents of social transformation that are becoming more and more important in this period of history, when culture in itself is the issue that's driving so much social movement, so much social change, that artists who are aware of this and actually bring intention to this and are trained themselves or are trained in some way of working, and that's not everybody, it's the ones who want to do it, right?
Yeah, sure.
There's something really, really powerful and valid and legitimate that they can do. And since it's not covered in the standard straight-up curriculum for whatever they are, here's another way to look at it.
Yeah, I agree with you that a community aspect is valuable to art. I guess, though, my sort of hesitation on sort of, you know, basically sort of jumping into this kind of collective absolutism is that, okay, let's take the notion of theater. Okay, if I'm write and direct a play, yes, I would need the actors, and I would need the stagehands, and I would need the crew to actually help me in creating the play, certainly. And the theatrical sort of examples used in this book are like basically actors and participants kind of interchanging. And that's not necessarily something that will work. I mean, if you're trying to go ahead and perhaps write and direct something, if you have someone constantly sort of, you know, looking over your shoulder and making changes, you know, there is something to be said for having some sort of authoritarian kind of, you know, someone who's running things, or else if everybody is kind of making their voices heard, then nothing may not, maybe not, maybe it won't get accomplished. I mean, maybe in an improv setting, sure, you know, I agree.
I'm not a collective absolutist. Okay. I think there's a zillion legitimate ways to make art and to make everything else.
Yeah.
The one that I wrote about isn't really the dominant paradigm. It's not like your individual artistic production is now being threatened by people who want to collectivize you and aren't letting you write. That's not your reality.
Yeah.
Some of the things I talked about in theater, for example, are things where, like Boal's Forum Theater, Boal's assertion is that we no longer have spectators and actors. He devised a method of doing theater in which we have only the spectator. In actuality, there are people who are trained, who are creating the container for that theatrical form. They're working with people to devise a scene or a series of scenes that embody sort of generative themes for that group of people, what they are thinking about, what they're working on, what they want to pay attention to. And then as the scene or scenes are enacted, the form makes it possible for anyone in what would normally be the audience to call a halt to the action and replace someone on stage to show another way of resolving that particular thing. That's one thing. I also write about Cornerstone Theater in L.A. in there.
Yeah.
I write about A Long Bridge Over Deep Waters, their spiritual playmaking cycle, where in collaboration with 21 different faith communities in Los Angeles, they created a cycle of plays, each one working with professional theater artists who were very, very adept at writing and directing, but also a combination of professional actors and people from the community who wanted to act and participate, or in the music or in the set design or whatever, to do a series of plays, each of which surfaced something that was really important to the people in that community. So some of them were like black churches and black men with HIV, which was a big taboo subject in their communities. Many of them were strongly connected to their heritage faith and they wanted to be accepted.
Sure.
There was an adaptation of, I'm not going to remember the name of it, but you would if I told you. It was that madcap, I'd have to look it up, but it's a play from the 40s that was a very madcap, everyone's on stage, being wild play that they readapted with some Muslim institutions, and they called it an American Muslim remix.
Yeah.
And that was about, actually that was about gays in Muslim communities. At the end of it, they did a vast production that used some people, again, professionals and non-professionals from all 21 plays, and you did a cycle of plays based on La Ronde by Schnitzler, but adapted, you know, with this contemporary material. So there's a lot of tremendous artists in there. I mean, Bill Rausch, who was the artistic director of Cornerstone, he's now the artistic director of Oregon Shakespeare Festival. He has a play at Lincoln Center. Some incredibly talented, adept, professional people are interested in this form of art making.
I guess, though, the question is what makes something along these lines a community, as opposed to, like, say, for example, I was doing some research on, like, African-American theater not too long ago, and I had noted that in the 80s, in New Brunswick, they'd actually had an all-African-American cast of David Mamet's American Buffalo, which I would have loved to have seen. That would have been quite interesting.
Yeah.
But is that a community, or is that, I mean, I guess I'm trying to sort of understand what makes it a community and the role of the social issue or the role of the kind of switching something. Perhaps you can elaborate.
Well, let's use another rubric, okay?
Yeah.
There's a practice that I write about called community cultural development or community arts. What makes it community arts is if the artists, acting as artists and organizers, are collaborating with the people who are not professional artists in a way that gives everybody substantial roles in the creation of the piece.
Okay.
So that's a dividing line between real community arts and using the conventional container, the conventional forms, but casting it with different people.
But if you're actually relying upon non-professionals for these kind of community projects, the question then becomes, well, what of the artistic quality of these particular things? I mean, you know, I hate to sound elitist, but, you know, the fact remains that some people are good at certain things more than others. And that might kind of come into a sort of, I guess, for a community project to be realized and to get the proper sort of critical reception, you know, it would have to have some degree of quality behind it. So if you actually have something initiated by non-professionals or everyday people, how does this become artistic? How
these are collaborations,
yes,
between people who are really highly trained and skilled,
okay,
in these particular forms, but whose commitment is to use those forms to help other people to also get in touch with and realize and express their own creative visions for their communities or their own aspirations or their own fears, their own concerns, whatever the particular piece happens to be. So, for example, I write about a dancer in there, yeah, Liz Lerman. She has a company based in Washington, D.C. They also did a large collaborative national cycle around the same time as Cornerstone did. They did a lot of different kinds of work. She's a MacArthur Award winner as a choreographer. You know, there's a lot of really talented and skilled people who, for whatever reason, decided it's not satisfying to themselves to create their art in a way that's disconnected from the question of other people's creativity and other people's lives. And so they decided that they want to develop their gifts with just as much skill and intention as you do.
Yeah.
And they want it to be just as good as you want it to be.
Sure.
And they want to do that at the service of the emancipation and development of a deeper, richer community for a lot of people.
Okay, so what I'm getting at here, what I'm actually hearing, is that to have a thriving new creative community, you need to have a sort of pluralism between professionals and amateurs. Or are you sort of advocating a kind of any community goes? Or is this kind of, I guess, connection between, you know, people who are really involved with theater versus everyday people, is this what is vital for a community?
Well, the best work of this kind, community cultural development that I'm talking about,
yeah,
has people who are really skilled in different ways, and some of those people will be skilled in art making.
Mm-hmm. Got you. Okay, so then what of I guess some of the other things you describe in this, like, for example, the great mural in Los Angeles you describe.
Yeah, the Great Wall of L.A.
The Great Wall of L.A. that is unfortunately now on the fritz because of funding. But that whole thing is a matter of, I guess, a community coming together. It seems, based off of my observations, to be largely just everyday kind of, I mean, I hate to use the word, but common artists or everyday artists would probably be a better word. And I guess the question is, how does community, I mean, I guess I'm still trying not understanding exactly how you can find sort of artistic value attached to creative community, or is artistic value even an issue in creative community development?
Well, nobody sets out to make bad art,
yeah,
and for many of the people who are involved in this practice, making good art is a really important value. The difference between them and some other more conventional practitioners is it's not the only value.
Yeah.
They want to make also good connections. They want to feel that the experience creates an opening for other people to discover if they want to be artists themselves or if they want to use their creativity in a socially valuable way themselves. They want to make some statements about what's important. So the Great Wall of LA, that's a project of the Social and Public Art Resource Center in Los Angeles, in Venice. Judith Francisco Baca is the artist who started Spark. And the Great Wall is her conception. It's in a dried out irrigation wash in Southern California, and decade by decade, it began a long time ago when this was
the 60s, right?
You know, I'm thinking Judy started in the early 70s, but we'd have
right.
to look it up and see.
Yeah.
But at a point when the notion of the great white man theory of history was still the dominant notion, and the idea
yeah.
of rediscovering the contributions of other peoples to California's, in this case's, history was an insurgent idea still. And so it's decade by decade the history of the state from multiple points of view instead of that one dominant point of view that valorizes certain acts and certain contributions and just dismisses others. She's an incredibly adept artist. She has another practice, an exhibition practice of her own. She teaches at, you know, I don't remember if it's USC or UCLA, but she's a tenured professor. She has all the, you know, she's passed go all the different ways. She has all the credentials of anyone, any exhibiting artist. Mm-hmm. But her commitment is that her artwork takes on extended meaning and extended value if it also helps to express something collective. So, for example, a lot of the work that she's done, it takes the form of some sort of a monument. You know, there's a monument in Baldwin Park that I write about in indigenous dances that I write about in the book that a racist group, an anti-immigrant group, tried to shut down. She calls those things sites of public memory. To me, that's a really rich phrase, because in contradiction to the standard monument, you know, the general on the horse, which is a social statement that says, we as a people want to commemorate the special great deeds of this one individual who has more power than the rest of us and rescued the rest of us in some way.
Yeah.
Sites of public memory say, we want to make a collective remembrance here to honor all the ancestors who contributed to this. Just to me, that's so infinitely superior as a public gesture.
But when we talk of collective memory, there's also the notion of shifting memory, and there's also the problem, as we sort of alluded to earlier, about the Wall of Los Angeles now kind of in this unfortunate retrograde status.
Because they're raising money to fix it up.
Yeah, they're raising money to fix it up, but the question is the permanence of art and also the ever-shifting nature of art. One thing that I didn't really see so much in this book was ongoing, I suppose, creative collective, where you basically have people, I guess, constantly sort of modifying things. I mean, is there a sort of danger, perhaps, in constant modification, or must art be I mean, the nature of collectivism is, I suppose, constant change, and the nature of art is, for the most part, permanent. You know, Guernica stands permanently. No one's going to come up and just, you know, do some touch-ups on it.
Yeah, but for every Guernica, there's an infinite number of works that are absolutely impermanent and ephemeral, and they completely disappeared.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I can't say art is forever. In fact, you know, the museums that are down the block from where we're sitting now, they've only been there a short time in the relative scheme of things, but you would already be able to see things that were in fashion in a particular moment that seemed to express something that was worth mounting on the walls of the museum, that they would never go up again already.
Yeah.
You know that.
Yeah, of course. Just like, you know, people don't have padded shoulders and big hair anymore.
That's right. But, you know, most of these people who I most admire as the creative workers in this field are really interested in constantly revising. So Judy Baca, for example, she's done a lot of digital murals in the last few years, and that's been really interesting work.
Gotcha. Let's see. I wanted to actually ask you about the section of the book called An Exemplary Tale, which set out this kind of ideal example of how a creative community should function. The one thing I wanted to ask you about this is that, you know, okay, so you have people setting their time and their talents to a whole day of activity, particularly like an impoverished community or people who are living in poverty. But realistically, most people don't have that kind of notion of that. They don't have that time sometimes. And I'm wondering, you know, and not only that, but there's also the idea here that it's pretty idealistic of you for the whole community to completely succeed. So I guess I wanted to kind of ask you about this. I mean, what can be done to get people in that particular mindset? And why didn't this exemplary tale section kind of account for the notion of, well, you know, some people might feel a certain sense of enlightenment from this project. Other people might say, "Yeah, what the hell is this? This is ridiculous. This is absurd." I mean, this is kind of the danger, isn't it? Not of forming a creative community. I mean, it's not always going to be access to everyone. It's not going to be great for everybody, you know.
Yeah, I don't see it as a danger. It's just the way the world is, right? I mean, whatever you might have to offer is there for the people who are able to receive it and the people who are able to participate. That must be true for you as an artist too. In that chapter of the book, I set out to do something that's really hard, which is to create a kind of ideal laboratory situation, because I wanted to show a step-by-step unfolding of a complicated project. Since in the rest of the book I'm referring to these projects, and you know, you can have a paragraph or two about how something works, I felt it was important to give people kind of a snapshot. So there were some oppositional voices in that tale. There were some people from the Chamber of Commerce who wanted to censor what they were doing, if you'll recall.
Yeah.
And clearly not everybody would ever participate. Some people don't care at all. That's a danger of giving an example, but yeah.
Well, there's also, going back to this idea we were talking earlier about, like, pretty much from Reagan onward, art has not exactly been a great sort of government-funded sort of aspect.
You could say that.
And I, based off of the fact that the United States really just does not fund arts, and how art is, from your examples in this book and in our conversation here, it's something that is absolutely vital towards a community. Well, if people don't value art, if the system we have doesn't value art, what is done? I mean, do we look for private resources who will then go ahead and basically dictate their own particular statements about what a, quote, community is? I mean, a Walmart opens and they have a so-called community event in a small town, and it becomes a Walmart town. And I guess there's something not so creative or communal about that.
Yeah, no, you're putting your finger on a hard question, because I write somewhat in the book about cultural development in other countries to contrast the funding situation between here and the United States. And it's true, our funding system is the most undernourished, you know, on a per capita basis or wherever you want to measure it, in the whole world. And people do seek more private resources, in contrast to, say, how this kind of work is funded in Great Britain or in the developing world or France. Yeah. So it's tough. And people, you read in the book how much people complain about the disproportionate amount of time they have to spend trying to finance their work rather than doing it or getting it out there. It's a hard situation. I don't have a great answer. I'm really hoping our government changes. It was not always so, you know.
Well, I guess this also goes into play the notion of, like, okay, an artist in the States up against these particular hurdles is going to produce art no matter what, because it's extant within her particular nature.
Thank God.
Yeah, I know. However, if you're talking about spreading this onto the community, I mean, you know, someone else is going to say, you know, I don't want to go ahead and devote, like, you know, all this extra time, years, as it often is, for a community sort of situation. So what then, how do you kind of corral this disparity between the sort of hardcore artist versus the sort of person who wants to maybe dabble in art but simply just doesn't have that kind of dedication? I mean, does it become a sort of community in which certain people are favored? Or?
Well, see, when you say art, it's tending toward an end product somehow. Like, you're implying the level of focus and discipline and continuity it requires to create a particular work, like to write a play and see it produced and so forth.
Sure.
That's a lot of congealed labor, you know, and tension that you're talking about there. So that's one kind of thing that I talk about in the book. The other question is not so much whether someone is set up to be a professional artist as to whether social creativity is something that we want to stimulate. I think it's a better society if people are out in the social arena, in the commons, interacting with each other. I think sharing music, storytelling, putting hands on to create collective projects like Altars on Days of the Dead, I gave as an example. Those are all social goods, especially if you live in a society like ours where there's a really comprehensive commercial push toward passivity and privatization of leisure time. You run the risk of having a society where lots of people don't mean anyone is that different from them. Lots of people only have objectified notions of what other cultures are like. They don't have any real face-to-face contact with them. Lots of people go around saying, I can't do anything. I can't sing. I can't dance. I can't draw. I'm the least creative person you know. I think there's a lot of social value in encouraging everyone to develop that side of themselves, participation, creativity, interaction, real curiosity, sharing with each other, even if it has no product, no long-term.
The problem with this, which, I mean, hands off to you for the idealism here, but the problem is we live in a society that values something like American Idol, and I suppose to some degree, like, this movie Dreamgirls is a bit of an offshoot of that, in the sense that we not so much celebrate art, we celebrate the rise of the amateur to become a star, the celebrity notion. And as a result, the artistic quality, the ability to parse and the ability to essentially have that kind of really devoted, siphoned passion towards creating something, I mean, this is a big disparity. It's an interesting sort of thing. It's a chicken and the egg argument, whether if we had more artistic awareness or funding for the arts, whether people might actually be more less concerned with the fame and more concerned with the actual art itself.
It's, you know, I think you're conflating two things, and it's understandable because they seem to be wrapped around each other all the time. art and fame.
Yeah.
But actually, there's no intrinsic connection, right? The
well,
fame
I agree
is,
with you. Yeah. Just, I'm talking about the general sort of perception that is in the air. That is, you know, people who talk about the water cooler, you know?
You know, there's a lot of general perceptions. I mean, we live in a country in which we're fighting a horrible war in Iraq right now. We live in a country in which we're contemplating building a fence along the border between here and Mexico.
And Canada.
And Canada. That doesn't represent, I venture to say, your, or at least my, views of what we ought to be doing. And I'm hoping that those actions that are being undertaken on that level can be changed by popular demand. But before that popular demand can be expressed in sufficient numbers with sufficient volume to really make social change, people have to get off the habit of passivity. They have to get into a place where they feel that their words count and that they can speak their own truth in the public forum. And this kind of creative activity is one really strong way to do that, because it brings people out not to say no, but to say yes to what interests them.
But do art and politics really actually work together? I mean, we had a whole bunch of writers, if you will recall, in 2000 and 2004 trying to, quote, get the vote out to change things, and it did almost nothing, you know? I mean,
There's a lot of different ways that art and politics
mix.
I mean, I've listened to a lot of your podcasts.
Yeah.
Could you name one writer you've interviewed whose work is completely not political in any way?
Well, it depends on how you define politics.
Well, let's define it generously, and then you answer me.
Well, it depends on the latitude of this. I mean, you know, politics offhand.
I'm not saying elections. I'm saying asserting social values, criticizing the given social arrangements, suggesting that people are overlooking something really important to the society.
So you could define that as political, then?
Of course.
Okay.
And you do too, I bet.
Well, you know, I'll go ahead and hide behind the interviewer's mask. I wanted to ask you about sort of the dangers of a creative community. I mean, would you count, since we're on the topic of politics, would you count, like, for example, Stalinism as a creative community? Certainly, it's the absolute sort of antithesis, and yet it shares similar qualities in the sense that, okay, you must go ahead and develop all these artistic projects. I mean, poor Shostakovich had to basically write to appease the state, and this created all this retrograde art.
But Ed, you didn't read one word in my book in which I said that people should be compelled to do anything, did you? Everything I say is the opposite of compulsion. All of this is about the question of what people uncoerced freely choose to express. My critique of the cultural climate of the society as we experience it now is that there's a lot of coercion that says to a lot of people, shut up and sit down. Stalin is just the opposite of what I believe in every way. It's hard for me to imagine any connection at all.
I guess, though, I mean, because you're actually asking, hey, we need to go ahead and create some sort of project, like the exemplary tale that you had mentioned, and that requires you to devote all this time, and at the same time, you're describing all these examples of people who have to, like, sort of, I guess, abdicate their individual will or their potential to sort of, I guess, you know, kind of infringe upon another person's right to express themselves, so therefore you have all this kind of clashing. I'm just trying to sort of understand. Okay. Yes, we've suggested here, we've imputed here that coercion is obviously not a factor in a creative community. But at the same time, there is this kind of, I guess, maybe almost subconscious coercion, because you have to get people to do something.
Well, not really. There's a discussion of. Let me answer it in two ways. There's a discussion in there of what qualifies an artist. How is an artist trained to do this kind of work if this is what they choose to do? And you'll recall how I said not everybody is dispositionally qualified for this. For some people, the driving force is to express something from within themselves, and they're really not interested in the collaboration. For the people who are really great at it, the collaboration is intrinsic. And of course, there are many artists in more conventional forms for whom some type of collaboration is of interest as well. So, you know, that's become more generalized. I hear in your question that it feels like the problem is to get people to want to do this, but that's not my experience. My experience is that for all the projects that I wrote about there, there's more demand that can possibly be satisfied by the available support right now. That's the problem. Cornerstone could do five times as many plays, you know. Spark could do five times as many murals, you know. The Dance Exchange could do five times as many dance projects. If the support were there for them to do it, they're under participation is not their problem. Mm-hmm. So I guess a lot of what I'm saying is predicated on having had that experience and seeing how intense the desire. You know, Freire, Paulo Freire, who I quote, the resilient educator, he talks about this inbuilt desire to speak with one's own voice and say one's own words. Mm-hmm. For me, that's the definition of making art. Mm-hmm. Not everybody wants to be an artist, but I think everyone within themselves has that desire to be truthful to themselves, to articulate, to make the world.
I'm absolutely with you on that part. I guess the question is when these truths kind of, I guess, run against each other. Obviously, you can have success in a blending of truths to create another truth, but at the same time, if you're sort of suggesting to someone, oh, well, my truth is better than yours, or which truth do we decide upon?
Well, what would be, help me out, give me an example of how that truth would come into conflict with another truth.
Well, if you are, for example, you to use the example I had used earlier, if I am writing or directing a play or something like that.
You don't want to do this collaborative work, right? You're, as an individual, wanting to do your own work.
If
so, then I say, good luck to you, you're not doing this.
Yeah. But I guess the point is though, you know, in terms of theatrical plays, you have to agree on something. I mean, this is the great sort of problem I'm describing here in terms of how do you kind of create a community in which everyone's truth can be accepted, but at the same time, everybody kind of comes to terms with the fact that, oh, well, we're all going to have to decide upon something. I mean, you're inevitably going to have to dispose of certain variables when you go ahead and put together a piece of art.
Well, let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. In Mendocino County, north of here, there's a lot of controversy around a period of time when timber, which was a huge industry there and a big part of the economy and therefore a big political power, was starting to make noises about moving out of Mendocino County. And the ostensible reason was the environmentalists were so bad, the spotted owl was putting the timber workers out of business and all that kind of stuff. So there began to be a lot of really polarized clashes in the community in which each side was stating intractable positions. The environmentalists wanted clear cutting to stop. They wanted the big industrial timber harvesters to shift to sustainable management of the forest. And the timber harvesters were saying there's only one way to do this, and it's our way, and if you want jobs here, you have to do it our way.
Yeah.
So a theater company there, the Ukiah Players, worked with a playwright, Doug Patterson, to take oral histories from a very, very wide range of people in the community, from Native Americans whose family has been there for hundreds of years, interacting with the forest, living with it in a different way, to kind of back to the land hippies who'd come up, you know, 20, 30 years ago, to old line agricultural families, to timber industry people, to loggers in the woods, to people who worked for the National Forest Service, the entire range. Everyone telling, without having to justify it, prove it, be contradicted, their story of what this meant to them and what they thought this meant to the community and what they thought should happen. And then using a lot of skill as a playwright, crafted this material into a play called Uprooted, in which all those voices were heard. Not every word in all those voices, just like when you write something.
Yeah.
Some things stay on the cutting room floor, but the yardstick was to fully represent the range of what had been expressed by all those people so that everyone who came would hear themselves somewhere. Not necessarily their own exact words, but something that really resonated with their deepest beliefs about it. And then that play was performed very skillfully and toured around the county and accompanied by discussions with people about, you know, what does this say for us? Here's all the points of view. What does this say for us? Did this touch you? How did you feel this? Did this enable you to see this in a different way? And it did.
Totally with you, except for one particular aspect of this.
Yeah.
It took someone to actually corral all those things together. I think what I'm really asking here is just the nature of having an organizer or having a sort of authoritarian or having someone who is just essentially administrating these things. I mean, the question is this seems to me sort of something that is required to organize a project? Or is there something
well,
about
someone or a team or, yeah. you know, whatever, sure.
Or is there, you know, is this inescapable, or can you actually have sort of an anarchic kind of creative community? I mean, that's kind of my question here. Well, the level, you know, what level of anarchy are we talking about in creative community, or does it require some sort of structure?
Well, I don't equate structure with the imposition of will. Mm-hmm. I don't equate structure with the imposition of control. For example, you and I decided we'd sit down together by two microphones. It would take however long it would take. You would ask me questions, and I would answer them.
Yeah.
So that's our container.
Yeah.
I think it was pretty much the given container that came from you, and I was quite happy to go along with that. I don't feel oppressed by it in any way.
Yeah.
It's like saying, you know, did the pieces of material join themselves spontaneously together to make a dress, or is it bad if someone has to sew it?
Yeah.
What's wrong with that?
Well, no, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I am just wondering about the organizational aspects of this.
You have to be a skilled organizer, and people learn a lot about organizing doing this work.
Because I'm not suggesting that it's a matter of, I guess, you know, control. It's a matter of just, I guess, organizing stuff. I mean, people are capable of coming up with things like this ukiah play.
Yeah.
And they're able to do it, but the thing is there's still someone to, I guess, manage it. And I'm wondering if there's a specific kind of creative community that is just pure anarchy, pure lack of organizing, just people kind of getting together and they just pow.
Well, you know, a lot of my professional work has been as a consultant to organizations of different kinds.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a question that makes me want to put another hat on and say, even when you have a situation where that's what people are saying is going on, even when everyone feels absolutely equal and there's no rules and they're just duking it out together, natural proclivities, interest in having power, personal styles, metabolism, who knows what else, is going to create some kind of hierarchy in that situation. I've never seen an anarchist collective that didn't have a de facto head who just denied every day up and down that he or she was the head of it. Have you?
No, I haven't. That's the whole question here. I guess
so. I want to make it explicit. Yeah. I think it's so much better to have people come together and say, yeah, we need a container, we need a frame, we need a mode of organizing. You do this, I do that, you do this, we'll do it this way. These will be our rules and guidelines, so we won't step on anybody's toes, and we'll work, you know, Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney. I can sing, you can dance, we have the barn, let's go do a performance.
Yeah, okay. Well, I wanted to actually ask you about cultural development as giving a voice to the excluded. I absolutely agree with that idea of giving voices to people who aren't able to sort of, you know, talk. But again, going back to this notion of the, you know, some people are better than others in sort of expressing themselves, how does, I guess, a creative community work with a concept where, you know, well, obviously, whether it's artistic critics who are sort of suggesting that things are, some projects are better than others, or some artists are better than others, or whatever measure you want to use, what would you define, I guess, as excluded? I mean, what would you define as, you know, as someone who is unable to essentially express their voice, or someone, I guess the what I'm asking here, and I apologize for the convoluted
That's
questioning,
okay.
is the difference between a voice that is ignored because of its lack of artistic merit by someone, and the difference between a voice that is ignored because it is ignored unduly.
Well, you know, one thing that's true in the book is that I'm talking about both the micro and the macro level of cultural development. So you and I, a lot, we've been talking about individual products and projects and individuals and their roles.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the book is about cultural policy, which is really the macro level. What are the policies, rules, regulations, funding programs, ways of looking at things like immigration, education, and so forth, that governments or international coalitions institute in order to help develop culture in the way that seems more healthy for the society? You know, you can make an analogy with economic development.
Sure.
If economic development is making sure that the instrumentalities are in place to promote the movement of goods and capital in such a way that prosperity comes to all levels, cultural development is to have the instrumentalities in place so that information, experience, and opportunity in the cultural realm are also available at all levels. So the word excluded is used in some social policy. For example, in the European community right now, the concept of social inclusion is huge in their cultural policy.
Sure.
If you read their cultural policy documents, that's one of their top-level goals, is to promote promote social inclusion. So that has specific meaning in that context, that all these societies in which there's all these guest workers and immigrant workers, mostly from other European and North African parts of the world, have come into Germany and France and into Britain from the Indian subcontinent and Africa and the Caribbean. And the issue of social inclusion in relation to them is really clear, that they don't have access to the same educational opportunities, jobs. They don't hold the seats of power in business. They don't hold the seats of power in government. So if you want cultural policies that promote social inclusion, then you have these designated groups, these guest workers, these immigrants, these former colonial subjects, and you're focusing resources and programs toward them. So that's the primary meaning of exclusion in that sense. It doesn't so much pertain to an individual.
So it's more of a kind of establishment kind of sense, that someone who is excluded from the establishment should be...
It's more someone who's excluded from social power.
Okay.
And that culture can be a crucible or a conduit to start that journey of inclusion. It has a lower threshold, and it's more pleasurable, and there's more opportunity, it's more permeable than, say, to pick the economy as the place where you're going to start to promote social inclusion.
Well, Arlene, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure, Ed. Thank you.
Thanks.